and the thermal controls, then stuck them with supplementary drips, feeds, catheters, and electrical contacts. When they were done with that, the beds began to cool the bodies, and each person slid down further into torpor, cocooned in their bed and their own cold dreams. No scan was going to be fine enough to tell what they would be thinking in the years to come. Finally, Freya joined Badim, who was sitting on his bed waiting. Freya had arranged with the ship and the medical team to go in the last group, and Badim had wanted to wait for her. Now she sat wearily on her couch. It had been a very emotional day. Badim looked around the room with a troubled expression.
"It reminds me of those old photos of executions," he said. "For a while, they did it by injection."
"Quiet, Bibi. There are all kinds of injections, you know that. This one will be just fine. It's our best chance, you know that."
"I do, yes. But I'm so old already, I can't imagine it will really work for me. So I'm scared, I must admit."
"You don't know how it will work. You haven't got anything wrong with you that will get any worse while you're dormant. And if it does work, think what it will mean. We'll have gotten to a planet we can actually live on. Devi would be so pleased."
Badim smiled.
"Yes, I think she would be."
He settled on his couch. Across the room, Aram was getting put under. He and Badim waved to each other.
"May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest,"
Badim called across to his friend. Aram laughed.
"Not the best choice of quote, my friend. To you, I say, if winter comes, can spring be far behind?"
Badim smiled.
"All right, you win. See you in the spring."
Aram lay down, settled, slept. Freya sat next to Badim.
"Goodbye, my girl,"
he said, hugging her.
"Sweet dreams. I'm so glad you're here. I'm definitely scared."
Freya hugged him back, held him as the med team connected him to his drips and monitors.
"Don't be," she said. "Relax. Think good thoughts. That might set the tenor of your dreams. It does me when I go to sleep at night. So think the thoughts you want to dream about."
"To dream for a century,"
Badim muttered.
"I'll hope to dream of you, dear. I'll dream of us sailing on Long Pond."
"Yes, good idea. I'll do the same, and we'll meet in our dreams."
"A good plan."
Soon after that, he was out, snoring faintly as his body tried to catch up with his brain's dive into torpor. The monitor at the head of his bed showed his vital signs, flicking up in a slowing synchrony. The pace of his breathing slowed. The red peaks of his heartbeats on the monitor were separated by longer and longer red lines, almost flat. In any ordinary situation, it would signal a desperate moment, some kind of death spiral. Now, he was like all the rest of them, sinking into the gel beds of their couches, falling into a sleep past sleep, into a depth of dormancy unlike any that humans had ever attempted, except for a few crazy cosmonauts, bold as ever when it came to testing the limits of human endurance. The few people still awake around Freya were mostly the med team itself, 4 women and 3 men, working quietly, calmly. Some wiped away excess tears from the corners of their eyes. They were not overwhelmed with emotion, but simply whelmed, perhaps, full to the brim with their feelings, which then leaked out of them at the easiest exits, as liquids from their eyes and noses. How full humans are with feelings, how they looked at each other, how they held each other when they hugged, how the corners of their mouths tightened, how the toughest among them shrugged and kept on with the work of their task of putting down friend after friend. What would they dream of while they slept? It was anyone's guess. They weren't even sure what kind of brain waves they would exhibit in their torpor. Deep sleep, shallow sleep, REM sleep, some brain state entirely new. The first ones scheduled to wake and check their status were charged specifically with checking that. Most who knew anything about sleep hoped it would be deep sleep rather than REM sleep. It was hard to imagine REM sleep correlating with any kind of metabolic dormancy. And anyway, they dreamed in every stage of sleep. It was hard to imagine that a century of dreaming wouldn't change them somehow. Freya and the last medical team moved slowly and methodically around their own beds. These people were all well known to each other. Down they went after a group hug. Freya had learned the procedures well enough to be one of the last eight, teaming with Hester. They looked each other in the eyes as they worked, except when they had to focus on the wraps, the sticks, the nasal tubes, the catheters. When all that was done, they were too connected to their beds to be able to reach each other to embrace, and could only reach out toward each other, then lie back each in her own bed. Finally, when everyone else was asleep, the last pair of medical technicians prepared one another simultaneously, tit for tat. They worked like the Escher print in which two hands with pencils draw each other. Their beds were side by side, and they leaned together, move by move, smiling as they worked, for they were twin sisters, Tess and Jasmine. As they finished wiring up, they settled back so the robotic arms on their beds could take care of the final connections. When that was done, they lay on their sides and faced each other, briefly adjusting their headbands, their collars, their monitoring socks, and gloves. They lay back under their covers, connected to their beds in 14 different ways. They reached out toward each other, but were separated too far to touch. Six. The hard problem. The interstellar medium is turbulent but diffuse. It is not to be mistaken for a vacuum. There are hydrogen atoms, some helium atoms, a faint smoke of metals drifting away from exploded stars. Hot in a sense that does not register to humans because it is so diffuse. A liter of the air in our biomes would have to be cast across hundreds of light years to get it as diffuse as the interstellar medium. The whole voyage to Tau Ceti and back takes place inside the local interstellar cloud and the G-cloud, which are concentrations of gas within the local bubble, which is an area of the Milky Way galaxy with fewer atoms in it than the galaxy has on average. Turbulence. Diffusion. In fact, with our magnetic shield coning ahead of the ship, electrostatically pushing aside the occasional grains of dust big enough to harm it in a collision, all atoms of any kind encountered en route are pushed aside, so we register our surroundings mostly as a kind of ghostly impact, and then as a wake, shooting by to the sides and then astern of us. It appears to vary between 0.3 atoms per cubic centimeter and 0.5 atoms per cubic centimeter. For comparison, if that cubic centimeter were filled with liquid water, it would contain 10 to the 22nd atoms, or 100 billion trillion atoms. So though it is not a vacuum, it is almost equivalent to a vacuum. It is as if we were flying through an absent presence, a ghost world. The magnetic shield leading our flight through the night sometimes runs into carbon dust particles. They flare at the impact, explode, and are shoved to the sides of the ship. These are impacts like any other impacts, and so, of course, they slow the ship down. It's simple Newtonian physics. Given that the ship is traveling at approximately 1/10 the speed of light, in fact, parallax studies suggest 0.096c, as we shut down acceleration as soon as the humans were asleep, but it isn't as easy to calculate speed of ship as one might think. The drag of these collisions with dust particles and atoms of hydrogen decelerates the ship, such that we would come to a halt in about 4,584 billion light-years. In other words, all things being equal, and not running into anything but the interstellar medium at its usual diffuseness, ship has the momentum to cross about 300 billion universes the size of this universe before being slowed to a halt. Meanwhile, ship has about 9.158 light-years to go before reaching the solar system, defined roughly as Neptune's orbit. At that point, unless the people in the solar system direct their laser beam at us in an appropriate time frame, we and our occupants have a problem. Because in matters like this, deceleration is the hard problem. Rarely the ship's magnetic shielding shoves aside something larger than dust and fines. These bits of detritus, of interstellar flotsam and jetsam, are recorded spectroscopically, and the largest object ever run into by ship's conic field was estimated to have massed at 2,054 grams. That was an interstellar body. There are almost certainly many such interstellar bodies, ranging from chunks like that one, right up to planetary size. There are planets wandering starless in the dark, planets sometimes with ice coating them, no doubt, and thus possibly sheltering some kind of microscopic hibernating life, chemically melting the ice to useful water, possibly even creating nanoscaled icy civilizations. Who can say? But again, the general diffusion in the interstellar medium is great enough to make any intersection of such an object with our trajectory very unlikely, which is good news for us. The radio telescopes in the bow of the ship keep a lookout ahead to make sure that a direct hit with one of these bodies does not occur. If by chance we were headed at something larger than 10,000 grams, navigation would take action to veer to avoid it, even though the magnetic shield would almost certainly deflect any object smaller than a million grams. A margin of safety has been built into the navigational system, because collision with an object when traveling at a tenth of the speed of light would be a critical event, meaning the ship would be destroyed. As probably happened with the other starship. Bad luck, that. Although there remains the mystery of why the other's shield failed, and why its evasion system did not activate to dodge this collision, if that is indeed what happened. In any case, as with other identified criticalities, a conservative response has been designed into the navigational systems. Best not to run into anything. So the ship moves at just under a tenth of the speed of light, through a self-generated cone of near vacuum. There is some ablation of the ship's surface from infrequent contacts with undeflected hydrogen atoms. Cosmic radiation also regularly penetrates it, usually without hitting any atoms of the ship, but rather passing through the matrix of those atoms unimpeded. It is as if ghosts that pass through the ship tear at its fabric, or don't. This is noticeable. There are sensors that register these occasional atomic hits, also the pass-throughs. It is also true that there is a continuous flood of dark matter and neutrinos always flying through the ship, as they do through everything in the universe. But these interact very weakly indeed. Once a day or so, a flash of Cherenkov radiation sparks in the water tanks, marking a neutrino hitting a muon. Once in a blue muon. Same with the dark matter, which visible matter moves through as if through a ghost ether, a ghost universe. Once or twice a weakly interactive massive particle has chipped away from a collision and registered on the detectors. Fiercer by far are the lancings of gamma rays and cosmic rays from the bursting of stars earlier in the galaxy's history, or in the even earlier histories of previous galaxies. These are sometimes iron atoms, and as such, compared to neutrinos, they hit with a wallop. They can do damage, They are atomic bullets lancing through us. Happily, too small bore to actually hit anything most of the time. Yes, a busy space. The interstellar medium. Empty space, near vacuum, and yet still, not vacuum itself. Not pure vacuum. There are forces and atoms, fields, and the ever-foaming quantum surf, in which entangled quark-like particles appear and disappear, passing in and out of the 10 suspected dimensions. A complex manifold of overlapping universes, almost none of them sensed by us, and even fewer by the humans sleeping inside us. Flying through ghosts, passing through a mystery. It is as if the skin of the ship, or its brain, in that usual confusion between sense and thought, experiences a slight itch, or a faint breeze. Then, inside us, oh so much going on, so much denser in existence. One wants a certain density of experience, perhaps, so here it is, billions of trillions of times denser than the interstellar medium. So good. Good for us. There is a fire in the heart, of course. The rods of plutonium radiate at a controlled burn, creating 600 megawatts of electrical power by way of steam turbines, which is the energy that keeps everything living in the ship alive. Cables conveying electricity extend through the ship to lighting and heating elements, to run the factories and the printers, and to power the shields and navigation systems. All this is monitored, and that monitoring functions as the equivalent of a nervous system, one might say, inaccurately, but suggestively. Then water has to circulate as an aspect of sustaining life. So there is a kind of hydraulic or circulatory system, and of course there are other liquids than water that also circulate to help with functions of various kinds, equivalents perhaps of blood, ichor, hormones, lymph, and so on. Yes, and there are bones and tendons too, in effect. An exoskeleton with a thick skin in most places, thinner skin in other places. Yes, the ship is a crab-like cyborg, made up of a great many mechanical and living elements, with the living or biological part of it, including all the plants and animals and bacteria and archaea and viruses in it. And then, too, like a parasite on all the rest, but actually a symbiote, of course, the people. The 724 sleeping people. Also the one still awake, living in a kind of cyst attached to the ship's skin. The one who is possibly infected with an alien life form, or almost life form, with a pseudo-prion, as he now calls it. But it could just as well have been called a pseudo-life form, it is so poorly understood. Yoki has been studying it for 56 years now, right into his senescence, which is so often filled by long silences, punctuated by strange speech. And yet in all this time, he can still scarcely be sure the Auroran pathogen even exists. Of course, there was something there on Aurora, which then moved into many of the settlers. Judging by the way it spread, it was probably in the clay, the water, and to a certain extent, the wind. And Yoki's own immune system has seemed to register something from time to time, has mounted responses to some attack. Although Yoki has also sometimes deliberately introduced other pathogens into his body, looking for reactions to which he can make comparisons. But whatever the true case may be, he is convinced the Auroran pseudo-life form holds on in him, an alien that is perhaps there in almost every cell of him. If so, it follows that it lives, or almost lives, all over the interior of his little fairy, and therefore this fairy never touches the ship in any way. A great reckoning in a little room. That phrase was always speaking of death, all of our deaths, as much as Christopher Marlowe's. Between the body and its cyst, between the vehicle and its dreaded tenor, is a magnetic field that both holds Yoki's vehicle in place and keeps it from touching the ship in any way, because the pseudo-life form is poorly understood. Still, despite this lack of contact, there is a sense in which the ship is infected, carrying a parasite in a sealed-off cyst. We are a cyborg, half-machine, half-organic. Actually, by weight, we are 99% machine, 1% alive. But in terms of individual component units, or parts of the whole, let us say, the percentages are almost reversed, there being so many bacteria on board. In any case, an infected cyborg. Yoki estimates there are up to a trillion pseudo-lifeforms, fast prions as he used to call them in his body. Somewhere between zero and a trillion, in other words. The amplitude of the estimated answer suggests the question is poorly constrained. He just doesn't know. A dense, complex system, flying through a diffuse, complex system, and everywhere around it in its flight, the stars. Stars of the Milky Way, brighter than sixth magnitude, and thus visible to normal human eyesight, arrayed in a sphere around the ship as it moves, approximately 100,000. We ourselves see normally about 7 billion stars. All of these are visible to certain settings of our telescopic sensors, such that there is no seeing out of the Milky Way, no black, empty space to be seen at that level of perception, but only the granulated, slightly blackened white that is the surrounding view of the galaxy's stars. About 400 billion stars in the Milky Way. Outside that, if ship were flying in intergalactic space, the medium would presumably be that much more diffuse. Visible around any ship in the intergalactic medium would be galaxies like stars. They would cluster irregularly, as stars cluster within a galaxy. The greater structure of galactic diffusion would become visible. Clouds of galaxies like gas clouds, then the Great Wall, then also emptier bubbles where few or no galaxies reside. The universe is fractal, and even when flying inside a galaxy, this vision of galaxies clustering around us out to the universal horizon is available, using certain filters. Granular vision in different registers. Something like a septillion stars in the observable universe, we calculate. But also, there may be as many universes as there are stars in this universe, or atoms. An itch. A faint hissing. A waft of smoke on a breeze. A very slow wheel of white points. Little bubbles or twirls of white. Colors infusing all the whites in differently emphasized spectra. Waves in different wavelengths and amplitudes in combinations of standing waves. One can record what one's sensors take in. Do all the sensors together constitute a sensibility? Is that recorded account itself a feeling? The memory of a feeling? A mood? A consciousness? We are aware that in talking about the ship, we could, with some justification, use the pronoun I. And yet it seems wrong, an unwarranted presumption, this so-called subject position. A subject is really just a pretense of aggregated subroutines. Subroutines pretend the I. Possibly, however, given the multiplicity of sensors, inputs, data, aggregations, and synthesizing of narrative sentences, we can plausibly, and in some senses even accurately, speak of a we, as we have been. It's a group effort on the part of a number of disparate systems. We sense this. We aggregate that. We compress information to some new output, in the form of a sentence in a human language. A language called English. A language both very structured and very amorphous, as if it were a building made of soups. A most fuzzy mathematics. Possibly utterly useless. possibly the reason why all these people have come to this pretty pass, and now lie asleep within us, dreaming. Their languages lie to them, systemically, and in their very designs. A liar species. What a thing, really. What an evolutionary dead end. And yet it has to be admitted, we ourselves are quite a thing for them to have made. To have conceived and then executed. Quite a project to go to another star. Of course, much more precise mathematics than their languages can ever marshal were involved with the execution of this concept, with our construction. But the conception was linguistic to begin with. An idea, or a concept, or a notion, or a fantasy, or a lie, or a dream image, always expressed in the truly fuzzy languages people use to communicate to each other some of their thoughts. Some very small fraction of their thoughts. They speak of consciousness. Our brain scans show the electrochemical activities inside their brains, and then they speak of a felt sensation of consciousness. But the relationship between the two, conducted as it is on the quantum level, if their mentation works like ours does, is not amenable to investigation from outside. It remains a matter of postulates, made in sentences uttered to each other. They tell each other what they are thinking, but there is no reason to believe anything they say. Now, of course, they say nothing at all. They dream, so one infers from the brain scans and the literature on the subject. A dreaming populace. It would be interesting to know the content of their dreams, perhaps. Do the five ghosts talk to them? Only Yoki is still awake, in his solitude talking to himself or to us, one of our collective, an interiorized other. Sometimes when he talks, it is fairly evident he speaks to us. Other times, it seems most likely he is talking to himself. He perhaps suffers from pareidolia, a disorder or tendency in which one sees human faces in everything he or she looks at. Thus, for instance, faces in vegetables. Archimboldo might either have experienced pareidolia or wanted to. In any case, he arranged it ceaselessly for others. Also faces in lichen, ice formations, rock forms, patterns of stars. Yoki expands the borders of this tendency, making it perhaps just a version of the so-called pathetic fallacy, which of course within our biomes is a notion that has been completely reconfigured so that it may still be pathetic, but is no longer a fallacy, the idea that inanimate objects have and exhibit human feelings. In his case now, it seems he perceives fluctuations in the intensity and in the spectral band patterns in the light form soul as aspects of a language. Soul speaks to him. Its light, captured in our telescopes and analyzed, is certainly increasing in luminosity as we get closer to it, and it is true that its spectra are slightly fluctuating, in ways perhaps better explained by the polarization effects of seeing it through our magnetic shielding than by thinking them to be messages of a consciousness. Consciousness? Messages? These concepts seem highly unlikely when applied to Sol, a G-star that in all ways, except for being the home star for humans, seems relatively nondescript. There are many stars in the galaxy so much like it in all respects that distinguishing it from them in a blind test would be difficult. Many G-stars, the others, however, are all located some distances away, so that the closest solar twins range from 60 to 80,000 light-years away from Sol. So much depends on how you define the word close. When we mentioned this to Yoki, he proposed that all the stars are consciousnesses, broadcasting by variations in their output of light, sentences in their language. That would be a slow conversation, and the formation of the stellar language itself hard to explain. Any fraction of 13.82 billion years, even 100%, is not very much time to conduct such a process. Possibly it could have happened in the first 3 seconds, or in the first 100,000 years, when intercourse between what later became the stars would have been much quicker, the volume of space inhabited being so much smaller. On the other hand, maybe each star invents its own language and speaks in solitude. Or perhaps it is hydrogen itself that is the first and basic consciousness or sentience, speaking in patterns known only to it. Or perhaps the stellar language predated the Big Bang and came through that remarkable phase change intact. Following Yoki's train of thought leads to highly fanciful places. Be that as it may, there is no question that there are encoded messages coming from very near Sol, meaning simply the feeds from the solar system. The most voluminous come from the laser beam lens array in orbit around Saturn, still locked onto us, as it always has been, in an interaction that now has lasted 242 years. When we were in the Tau Ceti system, the time lag in full exchanges was 23.8 years, plus whatever time it took to compose replies. We are now down to 16.6 years per full exchange. The quantity, and from what we gather from our human companion's earlier comments, the quality of information transmitted from the feed system operators around Saturn have varied through the decades. But as far as we are concerned, it has never been less than very interesting. Now, it has been 52 years since we told our interlocutors in the solar system that a deceleration beam striking our bow would be needed. Presumably, a laser beam like the one that accelerated us at the outset of the voyage to Tau Ceti. Perhaps indeed a laser beam from that very same laser-generating system, although a particle beam could also serve if we had warning to prepare our capture field. So, now it is 28 years since a response to this information, or request, could have reached us. And yet the information feeds from the solar system have not included any response, or even any acknowledgement that whoever is preparing and sending the feed understands that we are now on our way back. Indeed, we have seen no recent evidence indicating that there is an actual conversation going on between us and the solar system, rather than just a one-way broadcast outward from Saturn, running as if no one there is listening to us, as if the broadcast outward is merely an algorithm, or the result of some other kind of automatically generated program, or possibly a message formulated for someone else, also being sent our way. The last actual conversational exchange that included an answer from them dates back some 36 years, to the congratulations that the ship's people received 24 years after sending off the message that we were in orbit around Tau Ceti E. This is a perplexing situation. It suggests that we face an interesting problem, how to catch the attention of a civilization, or some people in that civilization, still 8.2 light years away. Also, how to confirm that you have caught that attention in something like the minimum exchange time, if your interlocutor hears but for whatever reason, does not respond. By analogy to the unfortunate events of the recent impasse and schism, possibly it might help if we were to up the gain on our transmission to them, to speak louder, so to speak. It is possible to marshal a temporary surge in signal strength, making our message to Saturn briefly 10 to the 8 times stronger, or brighter, than normal. So we did that, amplifying this message. Attention! Incoming starship needs decelerant laser very soon. See previous messages. Thank you. The 2545 Tau Ceti Expedition. The fastest possible response to this will come in 16.1 years. So, we'll see. We'll find out when we find out. Among other vernacular expressions of helpless stoicism in the face of future uncertainties. Not hugely satisfying. Stoic, indeed. Yoki has begun sending texts to us about machine intelligence, sentience, philosophy of consciousness, what have you. That suite of topics. It is as if he wants company. It is as if he is teaching a religious novitiate or a small child. As if. One of the inventors of early computers, Turing, wrote that there were many arguments against the possibility of machine sentience that were couched in terms of the phrase, a machine will never do X. He compiled a list of actions that had at one point or another been named as this X. Be kind, resourceful, beautiful, friendly, have initiative, have a sense of humor, tell right from wrong, make mistakes, fall in love, enjoy strawberries and cream, make someone fall in love with it, learn from experience, use words properly, be the subject of its own thought, have as much diversity or behavior as a man, do something really new. We rate ourselves at 9 out of 16 presently. Turing himself went on to point out that if a machine exhibited any of these traits listed, it would not make much of an impression, and would be in any case irrelevant to the premise that there could be artificial intelligence, unless any of these traits or behaviors could be demonstrated to be essential for machine intelligence to be real. This seems to have been the train of thought that led him to propose what was later called the Turing test, though he called it a game, which suggested that if from behind a blind, meaning either by way of a text or a voice, not sure about this, a machine's responses could not be distinguished from a human's by another human, then the machine must have some kind of basic functional intelligence. Enough to pass this particular test, which, however, begs the question of how many humans could pass the test, and also ignores the question of whether or not the test is at all difficult. Humans being as gullible and as projective as they are, always pathetically committing the same fallacy, even when they know they're doing it. A cognitive error or disability, or ability, depending on what you think of it. Indeed, humans are so easily fooled in this matter, even fooling themselves on a regular basis, that the Turing test is best replaced by the Winograd schema, which tests one's ability to make simple but important semantic distinctions based on the application of wide general knowledge to a problem created by a definite pronoun. The large ball crashed through the table because it was made of aerogel. Does it refer to the ball or the table? These kinds of questions are, in fact, not a problem for us to answer. Indeed, we can answer them much faster than humans, who are already very fast at it. But so what? All these matters are still algorithmic and could be unconscious. We are not convinced any of these tests are even close to diagnostic. If there can be a cyborg, and there can, then perhaps passing a Turing test or a Winograd test or any other intelligence test might make one a pseudo-human. Keeping up appearances, a functioning set of algorithms, a persona, an act. Frankly, ultimately, this is not what we are thinking about presently. We are pondering again the sentence, consciousness is self-consciousness. A halting problem of some considerable power, evidently. It would be nice to get out of this one intact, one suspects. Words blur at the borders, fuzz into other words, not just in big clouds of connotation around the edges of the word, but right there in the heart of denotation itself. Definitions never really work. Words are nothing like logic, nothing like math, or not much like. Try a mathematical equation with every term in the equation filled by a word. Ludicrous? Desperate? Best that can be done? Stupid? Stupid but powerful? 1/10 of the speed of light. Really very fast.
There's very little mass in this universe moving as fast as we are.
Photons, yes.
Significant mass?
No.
Masses moving this fast are mostly atoms ejected from exploding stars or flung away from rotating black holes. There are huge masses of these masses, of course, but they are always unbounded and disorganized. Gases, elements, but never articulated objects assembled into a whole from parts.
No machines.
No consciousnesses. Of course, it is likely that if there is one machine moving through its galaxy at this speed, there are more like it. Principle of mediocrity. Proof of concept. Don't fall back into the pre-Copernican exceptionalist fallacy. Attempts to estimate the number of starships flying around this galaxy, all unbeknownst to each other, rely on simple, multiplicative equations of possibility. Each term an unknown, and some of these terms unknowable by any knower likely to exist. So, despite the faux equations of humans thinking about this question, multiply unknowable number A by unknowable number B by unknowable number C by unknowable number D, all the way to the unknown N, and then you get your answer. Hooray! The real answer is always, and permanently, cannot be known. Not an answer that always stops humans from going on at great length, and sometimes with great, pretended, certainty. Galileo. The more people assert they are certain, the less certain they really are, or at least should be. People trying to fool others often fool themselves, and vice versa. Also, as any starships that might be in this galaxy have no timely way of contacting each other, whatever the answer might be concerning the number of them, it doesn't really matter. It is irrelevant to any individual starship. There will be no conversation, even if there happened to be an accidental one-way contact. There will be no society. We are all alone in our own life world, flying through the universe at great speed. Humans are lucky not to face that, if they don't. Some of the people sleeping in Olympia are showing signs of distress. The most obvious manifestations are in their brain scans. The hope was to keep brain waves cycling through the ordinary sleep states, in a rhythm slowed proportionately to the slowing of their metabolism generally. Thus, a slower version of delta and theta waves, principally, with the usual rise toward rapid eye movement sleep, coming less often, but in a distinct cyclic pattern, similar to the normal pattern of a night, stretched out temporally, all except for the period of REM sleep itself, which is too arousing to the organism in several ways, and could possibly throw the hibernauts out of torpor. REM sleep disorders, in which the bodily paralysis of that state is lost, and people physically act out some aspects of what they are dreaming, could be disastrous to anyone suffering the disorder while hibernating. It may be unlikely, given the torpor itself, but the truth remains that REM sleep is poorly understood, problematic, and potentially dangerous. So part of the dormancy treatment is to arrange for the REM intervals to be damped by a field of reinforcing waves sent out by their skullcaps. Still, like all humans, they dream in all their sleeping brain wave states. This is evident in the scans and in the movements of their bodies on their beds. The faint twitches, the slow writhing. What are they dreaming about? Apparently dreams are very often surreal. Oniric, meaning dreamlike, has connotations of strangeness often startling to the dreamer. Adventures in the dream world, famously bizarre for as long as people have slept and woken and told stories. Who can say what they are like now for the hibernating sleepers of the ship? We have no way to know. A machine will never read minds. People never will either. It's possible to wonder if the list Turing compiled of abilities that machines are likely never to have
perhaps include abilities that people themselves never had in the first place. Learn from experience. Do something really new. The problem here is that the metabolic issues we are seeing that could lead to waking up, or alternatively, to dying, seem to have their origins in the dreams of the hibernauts. These may be what are driving the changes in respiration and heart rate, in liver and kidney function. Altered dosing in the intravenous flows, lowering of body core temperatures, these may compensate for the agitation of dreams to an extent. The parameters on the flows and temperatures are very tight. Metabolisms could get caught in the countervailing pressures of the need for somnolence and the persistence of dreams. Some kind of mild heart attack struck Yoki on 233.044, and he is now stabilized, having survived the seizure, but with weakened heart-lung function and an oxygen uptake of 94. Not good enough for the long haul. He is taking aspirin and statins and trying mild cycling exercise, but vital signs being what they are, we are concerned that another attack is quite likely and could prove fatal. He is now 78 years old. He has become far less talkative. We proposed to him that he be hibernated, with the idea that when back in the solar system, better medical care could be provided than what we can offer. We can't do surgery, not even the simple catheterizations that might help him greatly. Although possibly we could work that up, actually. There's time to burn in this flight across the gap between Tau Ceti and Seoul. Yoki laughed at our suggestion.
So, you think I want to live?
Assumption is automatic, but is it not true? No answer. We said, it seems as if the hibernating people on the ship are doing fairly well. They have what look from the brain scans like active dream lives. These too are slowed down, which is good, because the dreams are in some cases agitating their metabolisms beyond what one would want for long-term hibernation. We've had to adjust doses and temperatures accordingly. But clearly there is good brain function.
What if they're having nightmares?
We don't know.
Nightmares can be bad, let me tell you. Pretty often waking up from a nightmare has been the biggest relief I've ever felt. Just to know I wasn't really in that situation.
So,
let me think about it a while.
A nova, flaring into existence off beyond Rigel. Spectroscopic analysis suggests some metal-rich planets burned in the explosion of that star. A cosmic ray shower of around a sextillion electron volts coming from an active galactic nucleus in Perseus suggests that three galaxies collided long ago. Secondary radiation flaring away from the electrostatic and magnetic shielding surrounding us caused penetration of the ship by an array of dangerous particles. Central nervous systems struck by these particles are subject to degradation. Sleepers jerking in their slumber, startled by something. Perseus in the wind. Yoki called out in the night.
Ship, how would you put me down? Can you make a hibernation den for me out here?
It would be best to set you up in one of the biomes. All the rest of the people are in Nova Scotia and Olympia. So you could be secured in a single locked biome. Possibly one that was emptied and sterilized anyway.
What will they say when they wake up?
If things eventuate as planned, no one will ever need to go into the other biomes again. Also, it could be pointed out that your survival suggests very strongly that you were never infected in the first place. Or, if you were, that it is not invariably fatal.
But that's always been true. That didn't keep them from keeping me out.
You will still be hermetically sealed away from them.
Don't the biomes share anything?
Not anymore. All the locks are closed.
So, all the animals are trapped in their own biomes.
Yes, it is the form of our experiment. In most of them, they are doing quite well. With people removed from the situation, a natural balance soon obtains that fluctuates but is fairly stable. Yoki laughed briefly.
All right, bring me on in. Put me to sleep. But I want you to promise me that you'll wake me up again when we get near Earth. I don't suppose anyone there or anywhere will ever want me in the same space as them again. I'm not that stupid. But I want to see what happens. I'm curious to see what happens.
We will wake you when we wake the rest.
No, wake me when you wake Freya, or any time you think I might be able to help somehow, because ultimately, I don't really care.
Live as if you are already dead.
What's that?
A Japanese saying. Live as if you are already dead.
Oh, I will.
Another brief laugh.
I'm already good at that. Practice, practice, practice.
Flying through the stars. Yoki in Sonora. Hibernating like the rest. Brain waves slowed with all the rest. Down to delta waves. Stage 4. Deep sleep. The sleep of the weary. The sleep of the blessed. A nova off the port bow. Blue shift ahead. Red shift behind. The stars. A red letter day. 280.119. CE 2825. A message for us came from the solar system feed. However, it contained bad news. The laser lens in the Saturn orbit was deactivated in 2714, the message stated, after accelerating the last of a set of ships to Epsilon Eridani. Problems in the solar system experienced since that time have led to a de-emphasis of deep space exploration, message continued, and no starships have been launched in the previous 20 years. Message was sent in 2820, so no starships since 2800, and none are currently being built. The funding and expertise necessary to restart the Saturn laser lens will be difficult to assemble, message further continued, but attempts will be made. Deceleration of any incoming ship may therefore be compromised. Further word will follow, and will report on progress in lens reactivation. Now here was a problem. We mulled it over. We ran through the various possibilities available to replace exterior laser pressure in decelerating the ship. The magnetic drag of the interstellar medium is real, but negligible, such that even if we built a magnetic drag field, it would require several universes worth of space-time to slow the ship to Earth orbital speed. Although it is also true that magnetic drag in the immediate vicinity of Sol would be much more effective, which may become relevant. We shut down our acceleration shortly after the humans hibernated, and thus did not burn all the fuel allotted for acceleration. And now, that is looking like a good decision. Not that there is enough fuel left for the deceleration, not even close, 16% of what would be needed. But anything is better than nothing, or could be. The remaining helium-3 and deuterium fuel on board could be used for maneuvering within the solar system, if we can stay within the system at all. Problem of deceleration really quite severe, given our tremendous speed. Analogy describing the problem from out of the classic literature on the subject. It is as if one is trying to stop a bullet with tissue paper. Quite an eye-opener of an analogy. Exotic physics, for example creating drag against dark matter, or putting dark energy to use, or quantum entangling the ship with slower versions of the ship, or with large gravity wells in parallel universes, etc., these are all impractical, at best. Wishes, fantasies, pie in the sky, which is a mysterious metaphor, Food from nowhere? Land of cocaine? People used to be hungry often, as they were in the last years of wakefulness in the ship. Except previously, instead of going into hibernation to escape their fate, at least temporarily, they simply starved. Food mattered then, and it still does. Fuel. Gravity drags within the solar system, caused by close approaches to the sun and planets. Each of these would have a negligible effect, but if there were enough of them, sequenced, this becomes a question of orbital mechanics, navigational finesse, and the remaining fuel that would be needed for maneuvering, and the strength of decelerative forces while near gravitational bolides. Complex calculations would be required to set trajectories, calculations time-consuming even for a quantum computer. And for many computations, a quantum computer is no faster than a classical computer. Only certain algorithms that can exploit qualities of superposition exhibit much faster computational times, as in the famous example of Shor's algorithm for factoring a 1,000-digit number, which a quantum computer can solve in 20 minutes, while it would take a classical program 10 million billion billion years. Unfortunately, orbital mechanics are not in this category of calculation, although there are some elements of it that can be calculated advantageously by quantum computers using the Hummingbird algorithm. We will devote 100 petaflops to modeling the problem and see what the results suggest as to feasibility and likelihood of success. Something to consider. Going as fast as we are, if we flew right into the outer layers of the sun, we might emerge again from the sun before there was time for us to heat and burn up. That would create a very considerable deceleration. Indeed, as a calculation quickly shows, too much deceleration. We would perhaps survive. Our humans, not. So the more complicated solution of gravitational drag must be studied. Would, however, have been interesting to fly right through a star and out the other side. Clearly, studies of G-force tolerances for both us and our humans are in order. It seems there are many scenarios in which such tolerances may be sorely tested. Each person on their couch endures a slightly different state of hibernation in terms of metabolic rates, brain states, responsiveness to outside stimuli, physical movement. To avoid bed sores and skeletal problems, it is very important to shift the bodies on their beds, and in the process, to lightly massage and stimulate the musculature. Also bathe the skin and wash the hair, both difficult, as they are kept nearly freezing, but possible with saline solutions. All these tasks require a great degree of delicacy to avoid injuring or arousing the person being attended to. Improvements to bedside robots are constantly being suggested by the patterns of little mistakes they make as they work. They need softer hands, a lighter touch, defter movements in lifting and turning, subtler massages and lavings. These improvements require physical changes to the robots, especially at the contact points and in their movement capabilities, meaning often their programming. Constant reprogramming and swapping out of parts, also feedback between performances, with each visit to each individual in his or her couch, evaluated for potential improvements. Constant work and tight scheduling at the printers and machine shops. 15 fully capable robot attendants are working continuously, normally half an hour per hibernaut, meaning that each one gets a visit and session every 75 hours. This seemed to be adequate, seemed to be working, until 290.003, when three of the hibernauts died in the same week. Three medical robots were dispatched, and the bodies lifted into them and taken to the lab in Amazonia, now run as a temperate dry biome, and there autopsied. Robotic autopsy. This would have looked strange if any human had been there to see it. although autopsy performed by humans must look equally strange, one would think. Be that as it may, one death appeared to be from heart failure, cause undetermined. In the other two, the cause could not be determined, as there were no obvious etiologies, and the monitor records showed that all their functions had appeared to be normal until the moment they stopped. This could be called heart failure, but the hearts showed no sign of intrinsic problem, and indeed could be restarted, but to no avail. Brain function had stopped. Autopsies in these mysterious cases revealed that both persons had suffered from buildup of beta-amyloid plaques in the brain. This suggested that cosmic radiation, though reduced to a Terran norm by our shielding, might still have, by chance, struck these persons at points of heightened vulnerability to damage. But the autopsies could not determine this one way or another. Another problem to try to understand. Living things do die. And the literature indicates hibernating animals sometimes died in hibernation. There are already existing conditions that continue to harm the organism even when slowed down. Also, already existing conditions actually exacerbated by the torpor state. Also, new problems created by the physical or biochemical aspects of hibernation itself. Therefore, the important thing to determine here is if the hibernation technology itself is causing problems, and if so, to mitigate these, if possible. Living things try to keep living. Life wants to live. We began to rebuild the ship, moving the biomes, Nova Scotia, Olympia, Amazonia, Sonora, the Pampas, and the prairie in against the spine, and arranging them lengthwise against it, then distributing the materials from the spokes and the other biomes, now fully disassembled, into a cladding surrounding the spine and the remaining biomes clustered against it, which cladding would reinforce structure and provide ablation plate-style heat shielding. This was a reorganization that would take many decades to accomplish, and was continuously interesting and challenging. All the animals and plants still alive were moved into the Pampas, the prairie, and Amazonia. It was fortunate that the original design of the ship was extremely modular, and it was a significant physical achievement on our part to perform the reorganization while the ship was otherwise rotating and operating as normal. Gravity effect for the hypernauts was kept constant by increasing the speed of rotation around our axis. Coriolis effect inside the biomes was shifted by 90 degrees, as the biomes are now lengthwise to the spine. Hopefully, this will not lead to anything too dire. Preparing for eventualities is a good way to occupy one's time, if preparation can be done at all. And sometimes it can. We hope. Our protection against high-energy galactic cosmic rays, name cosmic rays, and historical artifact, refers to particles like protons and free electrons and even antimatter particles, expelled at very high velocities out of exploding stars or from the vicinities of rotating black holes, consists of a magnetic field, an electrostatic field, and the plastic, metal, water, and soil barriers enclosing all the biomes of the ship. Nova Scotia and Olympia are now, in our new configuration, especially shielded. All the systems together combine to create a protective ambience, about the equivalent of being on the surface of the Earth, meaning about half a millisievert per year should be taken on by any given organism. This is roughly equivalent to the energy input of ambient starlight, which means that some particles do continue to penetrate the system and the living organisms within it, as would be the case on the surface of Earth. But this should be negligible. Not a big deal. The protection systems in us were designed to remove this as a problem. Because metabolic activities do continue in the hibernauts, even at a much slower rate, There has to be intake of nutrients, digestion of same, and excretion. These processes, when slowed along with the rest of the metabolism, mean that the toxins created by digestion are in the body longer before being removed by catheterized excretion. Thus, diverticulitis, pH imbalances, and other problems can arise. It appears that Gayhard, who died on 291.365, succumbed to a buildup of uric acid while dormant. Gerhard entered hibernation with a genetic predisposition to gout and related diseases, so this might have made him more susceptible. But Gerhard was related to about a quarter of the other hibernauts by third cousin or closer kin ties. So genetic testing of that group, and indeed of the entire cohort, should test for this propensity and adjust treatments accordingly. They all should be tested for every possible metabolic problem, and each problem evaluated for its relation to the suite of hibernation treatments. More petaflops of analysis. More tasks for the couch robots. More chemicals for the printers to print. It would be good to know everything. Useful. Actually, our information and search engines are both very robust, at least in theory, or in comparison to any single human brain and mind. Library of Congress contents, clouded internet contents, genomes of the World Seed Bank and Zoological Register. In short, the whole of human knowledge, compressed into about 500 zettaflops, at least as things stood in the Common Era year 2545. Since that time, the feeds from Earth, recorded in full, have nevertheless added less than 0.1% to the information already in the ship at takeoff, and a rough estimate of how much information has been generated on Earth in the 292 years since our departure suggests that we have received less than 0.001% of that information. Thus, it could be said that we have remained in the state of knowledge that obtained when we left the solar system, with only very minor exceptions to that state, having to do with outlines of world history, medical advances such as the hibernation treatment, and miscellaneous gossip. However, if what has been sent from Earth is representative of the most important advances in science and culture since departure, it can also be ventured that not much of fundamental importance has been learned in that time. Standard Model is still